Look, Bumble knows you're exhausted by dating. All the, must not take yourself too seriously, and 6-1 since that matters, and what do I even say other than, hey? Well, that's why they're introducing an all-new Bumble, with exciting features to make compatibility easier, starting the chat better, and dating safer. They've changed, so you don't have to. Download the new Bumble now.
On this episode of Narcissist Apocalypse, we talk with an abuse survivor named Elsie. And Elsie was married to a calculating, manipulative abuser. It's a story of submission, lies, rage, put-downs, identity erosion, and survival. Welcome to Narcissist Apocalypse, everyone. I am Brandon Chadwick, and with me today, we have Elsie. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you. How are you?
Well, I am doing well. Thank you for asking, and thank you for being here. And if you want to be a guest like Elsie is today, please do go to our website at narcissistapocalypse.com. Top of the page, there's a button that says guest form. When you click on that button, it takes you to our guest form page. There you can read all of our instructions and either send us an email at narcissistapocalypse@gmail.com or fill out our guest form and press the submit button. And please do send it in the format that we ask for. In today's episode, we have a content warning as we do graphically discuss extreme physical abuse. Sexual coercion and abuse is also mentioned on this episode, and we have a lot more swearing in this episode as well as we recreate conversation in this episode. So that is our content warning for today. And today we're going to hear Elsie's story, and Elsie's story specifically later. We do have a lot of physical abuse that is endured by Elsie, but on the way there was just so much calculation that went into the abuse, and it's just a myriad of different techniques that were used. So many people out there listening today, you will be able to connect, because Elsie had so many things happen that there's something in there that you'll be able to connect with and get validated from. So a big thank you to Elsie for being here today. And now I'm going to get out of my way and your way. Elsie, the floor is now yours.
Hi. Okay. My story is very old. I was married. Well, I met my abuser in 1982, and I married him and I divorced him in 1993. So I had had this whole it's over. It's gone. It's irrelevant anymore. We didn't have cell phones. It's like when you listen to other stories of abuse, I was like, my story doesn't belong anymore. And, you know, in the meantime, I knew I had the story. And every once in a while, my sister has me talk to a group of students or high school kids about it. But, you know, I was like, it's over. I'm healed. It's done. So then I also spend in the morning, I exercise. And when I get ready, I listen to podcasts. So I have a little bit of criteria for what podcasts I listen to. There need to be multiple stories in it, just because I don't want to keep finding a new one every morning. And I don't like a lot of swearing. That's my criteria. And then, you know, stuff I can associate with. So I've stumbled on Narcissist Apocalypse. And I thought it would be entertaining. And I liked listening to the stories. I was totally skipping the Q&A stuff. And in the meantime, I was also thinking about my story and thinking, you know, I've grown up a lot. I'm getting older. Maybe I could have stuck it out. You know, I feel like I'm more patient and more mature. And maybe I shouldn't have broken up my family. And then I started listening to the Q&A portions of the podcast and realized that, oh no, it's still relevant. It was still awful. And I couldn't have stuck it out. I would have died. So I realized that it was more than just drama. And it was more, the part I really like is about the person and how they felt And that's just why that the podcast provided a lot of validation. It also provided some flashbacks, but that's why I wanted to do this. So my history, I grew up in and still live in a very small town in Iowa. Small town, a lot of people have a different definition of what that is. This is like 5,000 people or less. So, and it's a good place. Like, I think we have three stoplights now, but growing up we had one. So that's who it is. My parents have been married to each other for, it'll be 63 years this summer. They didn't fight. They get along really well. They still do. They do everything together. They're very happy. We were the same people inside our house as we were outside of our house. And, you know, it was level and it was even, and there was no drama. I have three sisters. One is a year and a half older than me, and one's 2 years younger than me. And then one is way 8 years younger than, or 10 years younger than I am. So that the three of us were within 3.5 years of each other. And we were friends. We got along really well. But I was brought up, I know how to sew, I know how to play piano. I was brought up to be, but I was also told that you will be a wife and a mother. And, you know, marriage is for life. You will be married, and that's just how it is. Religious home, Christian religion, you know, some of that rule, you have to follow the rules, but a lot of that just unconditional love. And I feel like it was a completely normal, very small, but very completely normal household. We weren't incredibly wealthy, but it went fine. There was one incident that I remember when I was younger, a teacher who had taught my older sister and my younger sister, but not me. And I don't even know why he was talking to my parents. And he looked at me and said, "Oh, that's the quiet one." And I thought, "Oh, I guess I'm the quiet one, huh?" And, you know, I was probably in third or fourth grade when that conversation took place, but, "Oh, I got a label here. I'm the quiet one. I guess I'm the quiet one." I don't think that was true, but that's the label I would got, and that's the label I believed. Okay, so fast forward to high school. My first relationship. Keep in mind, I was brought up to be a wife and a mother, and it's always that, "Who's your boyfriend? Who's your boyfriend?" You hear that your entire life, and I refuse to ask my granddaughters that question. So I get to high school, and Christian school. So there were a lot of feeder schools. So there were K through 8 schools, several of them. And then they all came together for high school, which would have been 9 through 12. So it was a bigger high school than the grade school. And at that time, the junior boys swooped in on the freshman girls. And I got asked out. You know, 14 years old, got asked out by this guy, and I wasn't allowed to date him yet, but he was allowed to come over. But he was the on again, off again boyfriend of my sister's best friend. And my sister's best friend is a mean girl. That's a good description for her. And she didn't appreciate that I was after him, and I could hardly even remember what he looked like most of the time. He was after me. Anyway, that relationship really didn't last very long. It kind of fizzled out, but the mean girl had it in for me. And so they were sophomores and I was a freshman, and she had a new boyfriend who was also a junior, and her boyfriend had a friend, and that friend was known to be conceited. You know, an example of that is he would, when somebody said, "Hey, good game last night," because he was a basketball player, he wouldn't say thank you. He would say, "I know." So just that's who he was. And so they decided that he needed to go out with me. And I think it was to get me off the streets so that I wouldn't steal, that's in air quotes, anybody else's boyfriend. I don't know what it was. It was a revenge thing. So I ended up dating him for like 3 years. So age 14 to 17, I dated this dude. And he talked all the time about himself. He talked constantly. And I can look back at that relationship and he knew nothing about me. He didn't know who I was. He didn't know what I was doing. I was just the passive, quiet one again. and submissive. I don't like that word submissive, but I was. And I think that was the setup that taught me what relationships were, because I was so young and just, he talked all the time. So the relationship fizzled, cheated on me. And that was the end of that. And then I had a couple other relationships that weren't real long term. But that's who I was. And then after high school, you know, besides being told you're a girl, so a female, so you're going to be a wife and a mother, I was also told you have the world at your feet. You're smart enough. I had a really high grade point average. You're smart enough. You can go to college. You can do whatever you want. So I was going to go to medical school. I was going to be a doctor. And my mother intervened and said, you can't do that. A wife and a mother can't go to that much schooling. So I chose nursing instead. So I went from my hometown to a nursing school that was about an hour away. And it was a 2-year nursing program. It's called a diploma. And believe it or not, there are very few diploma schools in the United States anymore. And I don't even know if Canada, no, their system is way different. They don't even have diplomas. Anyway, so I was going to go to nursing school because I couldn't be a doctor. Okay, that was me. My abuser was the preacher's kid. He was the pastor's son, so he was from a good family. However, his dad was a highly respected minister, and they moved around about every 5 years. So he had lived all over the United States and Canada. We had actually gone to grade school together because they lived in our area, and his dad was our pastor. And then they moved away. So I didn't go to high school with him. And then they came back to the area about the same time that my abuser and I, who were the same age, at the same time we entered college. I went to nursing school and he came back as a college freshman. Now, okay, so we have this Christian school I went to, K-8, and then the high school, and then there's a college. And the college that most, I would say, oh, a third of my class went to was a local college, and it was also a Christian college. He was at the college where a lot of my friends went, but I was at nursing school an hour away. And so I'm in nursing school, and I was, you know, there aren't a lot of opportunities to meet guys at nursing school because it's all girls. It's nursing. So I was actually didn't quite realize how lonely I was. I had some good friends at school, but I was not in a relationship. And I had always been in a relationship. I had been in a relationship since seventh grade. And so it was like, I was lonely. So one night, a friend of mine from my nursing school, we drove down back home to the college that everyone was at, and we were at a dance. And it was right around Christmas time we went to this dance. And we had beer in the car, you know, we're talking the 80s. And we were having a good time and meeting people that we knew, because she knew people that at that dance and I knew people at that dance. And I ran into my abuser, and he made this big dramatic, oh, hi, it's you. And he fell over being dramatic. And we always said that he fell into the coats. There wasn't enough places to hang coats, and the coats were all just on the floor. And it was always like, oh yeah, when we met, you fell into the coats. And he, you know, he made a big dramatic deal out of it. And then we danced, and actually we went to the car and drank the beer, and, you know, and he presented himself as a lot of fun and very exciting and almost exotic. You know, he was not a local boy, and that's all I had known. He was going to get me out of Iowa. And that's kind of what my first impression of him was. So of course, then, about a week later, he called and we talked on the phone for a long time. You got to keep in mind, we got landlines. There's no cell phones. There's no internet. There's no computers. But he did call me. And then we went out on our first date. And our first date, it was like shortly before New Year's. It was after Christmas in between. And we're driving to go see a movie. And he, on the way there, asks me what my goals in life were. I had never been asked that by a guy ever. And, you know, so that was kind of impressive. You know, I said something about being a nurse and living by a lake, and I don't even know what I said. So I asked him what his goals were, of course. And then he said he was going to be a lawyer at that time. And I think, I don't even remember. The only one I remember was the lawyer, which wasn't true. He was never pre-law. And then after he asked that, he asked if I believed in love at first sight. And I don't remember my response to that, but he proceeded to say that he was in love with me. And I don't think I took that very seriously. I really took that to mean we were in a relationship, what we would say now would be an exclusive relationship. But really what that meant was we were a couple and I belonged to him. And I didn't realize it at the time. I was incredibly naive and we were young. So that night, you know, we go to see the movie and got a pizza or something. And then we came back to my house. He dropped me off at home and we sat and talked for a while. And I'm sure we made out on the couch, and then he asked if he could just spend the night on the couch and stay overnight. And I said, no, because it was just our first date. And what I said was my parents won't agree with that. But I thought I was being kind of bold by saying that. Remember, I was taught to be submissive. And so I thought that I was pretty impressive. But the next day he came over again and my dad was painting my bedroom just a different color and he helped paint. And so during that whole day, he told us, the family, my mom and dad and me, and probably my sister, that he had chicken pox 3 times. And I didn't believe him. I thought that was a misdiagnosis. That's not possible. And, you know, as a practicing RN now, I know that that didn't happen. But, you know, it was like, okay, I saw 2 red flags within the first 24 hours. The love at first sight and the weird chicken pox thing. And that's almost delusional if you think about it. But I ignored those red flags. You do that when you're in a new relationship. And he was a good guy from a good family. And I was supposed to be in a relationship and he loved me. And that's kind of where my head was at. And then the love bombing started. But you know what? I really don't recall that love bombing lasting more than about a week. It was more of a frog in a pot. And then the next week, we actually did go to a movie that I was able to choose. And it was something along the lines of The Lord of the Rings. I had read The Lord of the Rings long before it was a movie, and I loved it. I read it in high school and thought it was a great book. And so that was kind of the genre that I liked. So we did go to a movie, and I don't even remember the name of the movie. He told me that he indicated that he knew all about what The Lord of the Rings was about. I found out years later he had never read it. His brother had read it and wrote a book report about it, and he read the book report. So he knew enough to make it sound like he knew all about The Lord of the Rings. And then, you know, when you live in Iowa, your summer job is walking beans. It means pulling the weeds out of the bean fields. Or detasseling corn. You know, you work at the fields. That's your summer job. Pay was good. He told me that he had gone to high school in Ontario. And he told me that his summer job was working in the gladiola fields, picking gladiolas. And I'm not sure I believe that. I think he maybe did that once or he heard about it. But, you know, he was mirroring me. He was pretending to have the same interests as me. And I believed it. I believed he had the same interests. And then, of course, he chose our song. We had a song. And, you know, I've been sitting here racking my brains. I can't come up with the name of the song or the group. It was a group that I didn't know. It was his choice. But it was our song. And it was a nice song. And it was a group from Canada, because everything in Canada was way better than everything in the United States, of course. Anyway, I had to go back to school, so our main connection was the phone, and we had landlines. I don't know if any of you remember how landlines and long distance works. It's pay as you go. You pay by the minute. We had huge phone bills for even the 1980s, because it was constant phone calls. And I thought that was adoring. And, you know, it was love bombing. It was also keeping track of me. I can't imagine what it would have been like if we had text. I wouldn't have gotten anything done. He would have been texting me and calling me constantly. But my mind was, I was where I belonged. I was in a relationship on the way to getting married. That's where I was supposed to be. And he was fun and he was excited.
So here we are. This relationship is already, you know, this is within the first 6 months, everything that has happened so far. And a big reminder to everyone that you're very young here, 18 to 20 range, and lies have occurred, mirroring, control, love bombing has already taken place. And now within your story, we're going to start hearing about devaluing, but it's going to start first with this isolation process, then a myriad of manipulation tactics to erode your identity, gain control of you. And we're also going to hear a story about you seeing behind the curtain of him manipulating his family. So this next bit will all take place over 1 year. And this happens before you get married, and then eventually we'll get to when you get married. And there are a lot of different things here that everyone might get validated on. So kind of buckle up, as we'll be moving from tactic and abuses pretty quick, as just there's so much that happens with Elsie in this time period and in the whole entire story. But in this time period, there's a lot that's kind of going on in this next year. And there's just so much that happens as this person really hits on every single type from the Lundy Bancroft abuser type. So with that being said, Elsie, walk us through this part of your life.
I had something called roommate drama. That's where you got a roommate in college that you just stop getting along and you end up absolutely just hating each other. And everything they do bugs you. And so I didn't like my roommate. Now, I do have to say, I know her. I don't live far from her now. And we're not friends, but we don't hate each other anymore. we could sit down and talk for hours yet. But, you know, every time I would complain about my roommate, he'd be like, oh, but she's temporary and you have me forever. So he played on that. But he encouraged the drama because he was slowly isolating me. And then he started in on my family. Neither of my parents went to college. And my dad was a wage earner. My mom was a stay-at-home mom until I got to high school. And then she got a job. But his family, you know, his dad was a pastor, so had a master's degree. His mom had been to college. You know, his family was way better than my country bumpkin idiot small family. My grandpa was senile. You know, just he started just picking at my family. And then my older sister was married, and her husband was horrible. He was mean. And so he didn't like my sister's husband. And then my sister, who was 2 years younger than me, well, she was just a whore. She slept around all the time. And my youngest sister was the same age as his youngest sister. And they were both good athletes. But, oh, his sister was way better. You know, everything about him was just a little bit better. So he had me thinking my family was not good. And then high school, according to him, the students that he was in college with that were from my high school, they were all flunking out because my high school was too easy. It didn't prepare them for college, and they were naive and they were stupid. Whereas his high school was basically college preparation. It was like he didn't have to take notes. He didn't have to show his work. He sailed through everything. So suddenly, you know, my 3.8 grade point average from my high school wasn't good anymore. It wasn't what I thought it was. And suddenly I wasn't as smart. And you know what? I had been hearing that all my life, that we grew up in a bubble around here and that the people I grew up with couldn't make it in the outside world. So there was always a grain of truth in everything he said. But his motive was to isolate me, to get me home, to not like the people around me. And then he did this whole thing about my high school friends were saying to him that I was sleeping around in high school. It was always about sleeping around. It was always about sex. And so they were saying horrible things about me. So I stopped talking to my high school friends because they hated me, and how dare they say that about me? And, you know, it was more of the isolation. And then, of course, my career choice, the girls around here in Iowa only pick the female occupations, beautician, secretary, teacher, nurse. And his high school girl, the girls he went to high school with, they were doctors and lawyers and business people. And, you know, they were encouraged to get out of that little stereotype of the Iowa people. You know, so slowly I was like being devalued and isolated. He was keeping me away from everybody. So I had two good friends at nursing school. And, you know, in nursing school is unique. If one person has a test, everyone has a test. You all take the same classes. So if you have a free afternoon, you have a free afternoon. So you go somewhere. And we had gone to a matinee of Monty Python, The Meaning of Life. It's like off-color humor. and it's a specific kind of humor. And it was a funny movie. And I was telling him about it, and there was a song that we would always sing from that movie. And, you know, it was just kind of a fun thing that we did. No big deal, right? So one day I got to his house on a Friday afternoon after class let out, and he's glaring at me. He's furious with me. He had rented that Monty Python movie and was furious. How dare you watch this filth? You call yourself a Christian and you like this horrible movie. And he's like, high school principal. It's like, whoa. And, you know, grain of truth, Monty Python's not a Christian movie. But it's like, why are you going off on me over that? And I didn't know how to defend myself. I just, you get hit with that. And I think that was one of the first times he started yelling at me. And I can realize now that it wasn't about the movie. It was about your friends are leading you astray. It was about isolating me from my girlfriends. Because this is the guy who, oh, I tried every drug there was in high school and I was drunk all the time. And he was Mr. Number One bad boy, according to him. And I couldn't watch Monty Python. But I didn't defend myself against that. I just kind of took it. So, yeah. Okay. And then the demands began. So I'm being kind of drawn into, he's the only voice that's left in my head. And I was still doing well at school and enjoying school. And I was still with my friends at nursing school, but that's really all I had besides him. So the phone calls and the phone calls and the phone calls all the time. He had to know what I was doing, and we had to connect every night. And then my time became an issue because the weekends was all I had, because it was a quote long distance relationship. I was an hour away, and he knew exactly what time I got out of class on Friday because I told him, and I had to be at his place within an hour or he'd be mad. There was one day my grandma was in the hospital. She had cancer and she was in the hospital a lot during the one semester when I was there. And I had called the night before. I had talked to him like on Thursday night and said, I'm going to go stop by and say hi to grandma before I come home. Nope. He was mad. He was furious that I was going to do that. Well, I did it anyway. So I got to his place maybe half an hour later, and I walk into his room and he's laying on the bed facing away from me and won't talk to me. It was, you know, the silent treatment. And I went over to his stereo because he was so proud of his stereo and put the headphones on and started playing music. And pretty soon he's grabbing my shoulder, and I had not programmed the stereo correctly. So the noise wasn't just coming into the headphones. It was coming into the room. So that had to get him out of his silent treatment because he had to stop the loud music because his mom would have probably been upset anyway. And then he screamed, proceeded to scream at me because, you know, you're at that place all weekend and I only get so much time with you and you need to spend every minute with me. And so what would happen then was on weekends, he would sleep on my parents' couch because we had to spend every minute together. Going home, going back to school on Sunday for class on Monday was always an interesting thing. My mom didn't want me coming back in the dark. because it wasn't in a bad area, but it wasn't in a good area either. And it was in a bigger, I would call it a city. Maybe not everybody would. And she didn't want me, you know, walking from the parking lot to the building in the dark. So I was supposed to go back to school in the afternoon on Sunday. Well, he hated that because, you know, that took away time. And there was one day when I was at his house and my mom called his mom to say needs to leave. So, you know, got the authorities in there. So I was like, okay, well, I need to go. And he was terribly upset and mad at my mom for that. And I turned to say goodbye to him one more time. And he's sitting on the floor in his room with, it's a scalpel. It's from a dissecting kit that you would dissect a frog with. And I don't know why he had that, but he did. And he's making all these little tiny marks in his forearm and he's bawling and he was hurting himself because I had to leave. Which made me feel terrible. And, you know, I was like, oh, but I love you so much. And, you know, I'll be back. And yeah, but, you know, total manipulation. But so the demands on my time were huge. Eventually, I would drive back to school on Monday morning. And some of those days I had to be at the hospital to practice by 7 a.m. So I would get up at like 4 a.m. to drive back to school. Because he demanded all my time on the whole weekend. There was a weird thing about every time we were at my parents' house, we would be sitting watching a movie or something or watching TV, and I would have to make him hot dogs. I would have to feed him because he was hungry. And I was getting sick of that. And it's like, you know, my mom didn't appreciate that either. He went through a lot of hot dogs, but it had to be done. It's kind of a misogynistic thing. And then there's one night where we're sitting and he's all sheepish and he's like, I got to tell you something. You need to brush your teeth. And I was mortified. I had bad breath. So I quick brushed my teeth and that was it. But you know what? He asked me to brush my teeth every night from then on. Now, my oral hygiene was not that bad. I did not have bad breath, but that was a control issue. And I fought back against that, but there was nothing I could do, you know, because maybe it was true. And, you know, I took that as he needed me and he loved me. And a lot of those little things, I just didn't tell anybody. I was becoming one person around him and there was a facade in public. And that was hard. That was hard for me because I never grew up that way. A lot of subtle manipulations. Women can't cry. The only reason women cry is to manipulate men. So I was not allowed to cry. And unfortunately, I remember all these things and I remembered it at the time. And I don't know that he did. I think his gratification was just in the moment. So I think if I had cried like 6 months later, I don't think he would have remembered that conversation. But I did. And I knew that I wasn't supposed to cry anymore. And then it was like his parents wanted him to date a girl, small and thin. And I knew what that meant. That meant you're overweight, and I'm not overweight, but it meant you're not skinny enough. And then he said his friend had told him that all the girls in Northwest Iowa are pretty. So the message that he sent me with that one was, you're nice looking, but so is everybody. So that's not special. Just a lot of weird things. And eventually there was a lot of planning for our wedding. Every time I'd plan something, he would replan it. He would unplan what I planned and replan it. It was kind of annoying. But I was, in the meantime, you know, living in fear that something I was going to do was wrong or that something I had done was wrong. So I'm just being totally diminished. And he brought on a lot of shame. You know, I wasn't good enough. And in the meantime, the only voice I have is to listen to him. So was there even a possibility of getting out? I don't know. I didn't even think about getting out. It just wasn't what it was. And then there's this manipulation thing with hairbrush. I'm at his parents' house and everybody's mad. Everybody's crabbing at each other. There was a brother there. He had two brothers and a sister. And I'm not sure how many of the siblings were there that the hairbrush was missing. The brush was missing. And they were pretty sure that my ex was the one who took it. And, you know, he's denying it and everybody's denying it and accusing each other. And anyway, after that conversation, my ex and I get in his car and he reaches over and he opens the glove box and there's the brush. He had taken it. And I'm like, oh, you took it? And actually what I didn't do was grab the brush and bring it back in the house. But what he did by showing me the brush was made me a co-conspirator. Then I had to take sides and I had to take his side. And I don't know what stealing the brush was all about, just to torture his family or something. But you know, I think some of this was planned and thought out and some of it was on the fly, but it was all meant to be just manipulative. And I just didn't know how to defend myself because he was good at it.
So there are double standards in control when it comes to going out with friends. So tell us about that. And then tell us about his manipulation to pit your schooling against him. Like, which one you love more?
He convinced me that I was not allowed to go out drinking with my friends. The legal drinking age at that time was 19. And we were all 19. And my friends were scum. And they were just drunks. And I was going to be a married woman. And that just wasn't appropriate behavior. And I remember trying to explain that to them, that I wasn't going to drink with them. But I think they looked at me like I had three eyes or something. But I didn't. I couldn't go out drinking with my friends. They would go out drinking, but I stayed in the dorm. However, he went to the bar every, I think it was Thursday, because it was Canadian night in the local bar by the college. And he had to help the Canadians adjust to being in the United States for college. Okay, I teach at this college. The Canadians don't need to adjustment to college. That's just bull, but nope. There was this double standard. I couldn't go out drinking, but he could. There was this whole thing about I couldn't talk about school. So here's what happened. He called me up one night and, or one of many nights, and said, I think you love that place more than you love me. Meaning I loved school more than I love him. That is such a trap. There was no way I could win that argument. But I was like, no. School's taking up my time right now, but it's temporary and it'll be over and I'm yours forever. Nope. You love that place more than me. And there was nothing I could do, you know, except protest. No, that's not true. And finally I said, well, what, you want me to quit school? Yeah, quit. And so I hung up. He called back. I hung up. Finally, he said, fine, you don't have to quit school. Total change of tense there from you should quit to you don't have to quit school. But I hate that place. And you are not allowed to say anything about, I don't want to hear a word about what goes on in that place. And I don't want to hear about your friends. And you can't talk about anything because I hate that place. So, you know, this huge chunk of my life and my, you know, this, I was loving what I was learning. I wasn't allowed to talk about in front of him. So I kind of lived in fear that somebody would say something accidentally about school and then he'd get mad because I had to cater to him because he was hurt. He was hurt that I was away from him all week. It was always about we aren't together all week. We're apart. It was really hard. It was really hard to not be able to talk about school. I was worried about offending him by saying the wrong thing. And I had to pretend he was wonderful, but I was getting more and more anxious about saying or doing the wrong thing in front of him. But really, what was happening then was I was only able to look about 30 seconds into the future when I was with him because I was so caught up with, I have to make sure everything's okay right now and not make him angry. So I lived only living in the moment and not being able to see the big picture at all. One of my friends did start to see it, and she kept saying, people don't change. And I wish I had understood what she said, but maybe I wouldn't have. Maybe, you know, if it got down to it, I would have had to choose him over her. And so she didn't really up and say, you're dating an idiot and I wish she had, but I probably wouldn't have listened anyway. So I was just minimizing his behavior in private and pretending things were okay and just living in denial and fear.
So all of these manipulations are going on. You're not the same person at all anymore. You know, yes, you may have stated that you were always, you know, in a submissive role, but the abuse has really pushed you down this hole even further when it comes to submission, and you're walking on eggshells in every way. And in hindsight, you are getting these manipulation sideways compliments that at the time help keep you in the relationship. But in the aftermath, you can see them for what they are. So tell us about this.
During our premarital counseling, because you had to go to premarital counseling with the pastor, he told the pastor that I had saved him from a life of drugs. And I remember thinking, you haven't taken any drugs around me. I didn't save you from anything. But, you know, I took that as a little bit of a validation that I was important to him. And then I remember him telling his good friend how important I was to him when they thought I was asleep. And I think he knew I wasn't asleep and he knew I was listening. He would give me these sideways compliments. He would tell other people good things about me when he knew I could hear. He never gave me a full compliment to my face, but, you know, it was just little snippets of telling me how I was okay and how much he cared about me.
So he's also testing boundaries and playing the victim. So tell us about this.
He also would test boundaries once in a while. He was kind of throwing spaghetti at the wall to find out what would stick. One day we were at my house and he gets up and he's like, "Your mom told me I have to leave. Your mom told me I have to leave." And he's kind of walking around and I'm laying on the couch thinking, there's no way my mom told you that. And so he's like, I have to go. And so he leaves and I just kind of rolled over on the couch. And then he comes back just to test my reaction. I think I was supposed to break down in hysterics and run after him, and I didn't. So he didn't try that tactic anymore. That tactic didn't work, is what I saw. Somewhere along the line, he started calling me a slut. It was something about an old boyfriend who was in the hospital, and I was going to go visit that boyfriend, and that made me a slut. He was calling me that constantly. And actually, I did get him to stop by agreeing. I agreed. I dated a lot of guys. Yes, I'm a slut. However, then I became a bitch. I graduated from slut to bitch. Fucking bitch. And he called me that all the time for the next 10 years.
So everything that's just happened was all in just a year and a half. And that's a lot of stuff that you've already been enduring, so many different tactics and manipulations, testing boundaries, victim playing. There's just so much that was going on. And eventually you get pregnant and you're going to go get married. So what happens from here?
So it was about a month before the wedding. There was this thing called Friday night videos. That rock music videos were just coming out, and it was TV show. It was on at midnight and you could play the videos. It was an hour long show and they played like four videos because there weren't that many to show. And you could play that on the radio. The radio would broadcast the music so you could get the good stereo sound and you could watch it on TV. And it was at midnight and he had it all set up in his parents' house. His parents must not have been home that we were going to do this. And he had this whole big thing about rock, loud rock music was his jam. And so he had it all set up with, you know, chairs and the whole scene was set up. However, I had a 12:30 curfew. And for some reason, my parents had never enforced a curfew in my life, but they started. And they were going to take my car away. I needed my car because it was their car. And so we watched the first one and I had to leave. I had to leave. And he was furious, mad at my parents. You can't do that. We're getting married. And you and I'm like, no, I'm going to miss curfew. I have to leave. So I got up to walk out of the door and he came up behind me and knocked me down. He hit me on the side of the head, knocked me over. And it wasn't concussion level hitting, but it was enough to knock me down. And I got up and walked out of the house, and he's following, and I'm in the car, and he's following the car, running beside the car. I'm sorry. And he's bawling. And I just left. And I went home and I got into bed and I slept in the same bed with my sister and didn't wake her up. Didn't say anything. Just got into bed because that amoeba didn't know how to react to that. And the next morning he called, and I may have been bruised, but it would have been under my hair. You couldn't see that I was hurt. It hurt, but he called the next morning bawling, and I took him back and I buried him. Kind of have a few regrets about that one, but where I wasn't in that place, there was no way to stop it. And he had this thing about one-upping everybody. He had to be one better. He had to be one better than everybody else. And if he couldn't be one better, then that person had to be lowered a notch. And he did that a lot with me. He one-upped me, by proving his family and everybody was better. And then when he couldn't one-up me, he had to one-down me. He had to bring me down. And I saw him do that with a lot of people. And I just remember always thinking, he's a boy in a man's body. He is a boy who has the strength of a man. And then I was like, why did I stay? I couldn't. I don't know. And I really thought I could love him unconditionally and that would turn things around. And I really, really believed that getting married would help. And I didn't know how bad it was. I didn't know that he was such a liar. And I was just anxious all the time and not able to look more than one step ahead. And, I was getting very flat, no emotion. And even as I recall this whole thing, I realized I was just getting flat thinking about this whole story again. And, I didn't want anybody to know that I was in a bad relationship. So I pretended I wasn't in a bad relationship, and I was pregnant. So one of our wedding vows, I remember him saying it. I can still hear it. I promise to teach you with tenderness and respect and to encourage you in the gifts God has given you. I'm sorry. That's not funny. Yes, it is. It's so stupid. So here's the setting. We were newly married. He had 2 more years of college. I was an RN. The United States had changed their payment system for hospitals. There were no RN jobs. So I went to work in a factory. A smelly, yucky factory, being pregnant with morning sickness. And I also cleaned a hotel, and we lived in this hotel. So I was working in a factory that stunk for minimum wage. We did have some friends, but his friends were mostly the Canadian guys, and most of them were just players. They were all single, but those were the only friends I was allowed to have. So eventually he quits school his senior year, fall of his senior year. But, he did get a job, and eventually I got a nursing job. And we moved out of that motel and we moved into a rental. But I worked either evenings or nights, and he worked like the 2 to midnight shift. So the baby was born, and everything, I loved that baby, and that I still do. And, he's a great guy. And the atmosphere in the house was fine until he got out of bed. And then there was just this oppressive black cloud. And he would start yelling, and he would yell every day, and he would call me a bitch. And he would say that the house wasn't clean enough. And usually at mealtime was usually the worst. It was at noon. And he would usually throw food. Anything I made, he would throw because it wasn't good enough. And finally, I just decided that I was just not a good cook. There were a few things that went on, and it just a lot of yelling. And one unique thing that happened was when I was still working in the factory, I would have interviews for RN jobs. And before I would go to that job, he would scream at me and tell me how stupid I was. And, it was really, really demeaning yelling. And I was always like, that was so dumb, because that would have given us, a lot more money. But I think it was that he just didn't want me to be more successful than him. And I wonder what my demeanor was when I went into those interviews. When I did finally get my nursing job, my first nursing job, which I kept for 33 years. It was when he was out of town. And so I went into that interview as myself, not as this beaten down little person. And he kept saying, if you want to play fuck, fuck, we'll play fuck, fuck. And I have no idea what he meant by that. And I have no idea what I was playing or where that came from. But that was just another reason to make it my fault so he could yell at me. And I tried everything to get him to stop yelling. I yelled back. I got defensive. I tried to say calmly, but I love you. I tried music. I tried everything. Nothing worked. And so it was my job to control his behavior. Oh, sleep deprivation. Wow. Yes. I was working some night shifts. I was working day shifts or evening shifts. And, you know, I had the baby and he did nothing to take care of the baby. I think he changed one diaper once. And, you know, I was just exhausted and living just from minute to minute, unable to see the big picture of what was going on. There's some really weird behavior that went on. Keep in mind, I'm currently teaching a unit on psychosis. So one night he changed all the light bulbs in the house. All of them, whether they need to be changed or not. And there was something very, very psychotic that happened. One night I was laying in bed and I woke up to him with a knife to my neck, the flat, not the blade on my neck. And he's saying, don't wake the baby. Don't wake the baby, and chanting. And I think that was a line from a movie. I Googled it and couldn't find it. But it's kind of psychotic. And I don't even remember anything else except him doing that, waking me up with a knife on my neck. I was just puzzled. And no, I was so conditioned to not react to him. And he left. He walked away. And that was over. My body image was always an issue, especially when I was pregnant. We had three kids together. And during the last two pregnancies, actually during all three, I was a fat cow. I was just a fat cow. That's what he called me all the time. Just a lot of put downs about weight and image. Oof.
So things have really escalated: physical abuse, mental abuse, manipulations. You're just trying to survive. And then the sexual abuse starts to happen. So walk us through this.
A lot of sex, a lot of creepy sex, a lot of weird stuff that happened in the middle of the night. He would molest me in my sleep. And that was creepy. And I would beg him to stop. And he wouldn't. He just wouldn't. And then he would say, when I didn't want to have sex, it's my body too. It's my body too, as if I belonged to him. And then, you know, he would just scream at me to have sex and shove me all over the house. And finally, I'd give in because it would get exhausting. It'd be the middle of the night and he'd be screaming at me and shoving me. And then a couple times I'd get flowers the next day. Just a couple times that happened. But he'd always give me the flowers when I was at work so that everybody could see he gave me flowers. He was also such a misogynist. Women's work, barefoot pregnant in the kitchen. He kept saying that. There was a scripture passage he quoted all the time, 2 Timothy 2, which is wives be in subjection to your husband. And he took that to mean obey, period. And then he would, if he didn't want to listen to me, he'd be like, you're on the rag, meaning you have PMS. And he'd say that to me even when I wasn't. I'm like, but I'm not. But, you know, it was his excuse. And I was so conditioned to just take it and believe it and to just go along with it or minimize it or ignore it.
So then an interesting triangulation happens where he says he cheated on you with someone at work, but you don't know if that's actually real. But no matter what, if it's real or not, he uses it as a triangulation manipulation. So tell us about this.
The first time he told me about it, he told me he didn't have a condom, so he didn't do it. But then later on, if there was a sex act that he wanted me to do and I didn't want to do it, he would tell me that she did it with him, so I should do it. And so he's telling me that he had this affair and he's all dramatic. And he's like, what are we gonna do? Because I have fallen in love with another woman. And I was so stupid. I said, I understand how it's nice to be desirable. So I can understand it and I forgive you. You know, I was in control of his behavior and I had to.
So at this point, you know, as you've rattled off so many different types of abuse that have happened, you have stepped into the role of the submissive Christian wife. And that is the role you are playing. You know, here is this triangulation, whether true or not, he's using this person who may not exist to get you to conform to your duties as, and this is just a manipulation to figure out how to get you to do these things. And the way it sounds like you're taking it in is not from a point of view of like being angry that this is going on, but rationalizing and through what everything that has happened and how you've been had your whole entire identity come down to this. You know, you are just this thing now and you're not a person. You're not a person to them at all. And you're just this thing. And they're just trying to figure out how to make this, in a way, device work, you know, yeah, to my liking. And it's sad that that's what it's come down here, that we're talking about you as being an inanimate object or a possession, or, and that you yourself are in this role of thinking that, like, not that you are not thinking that you are human, but you have been dehumanized in every single way.
Correct. Except I could be normal at work and I could be normal with my children. If he wasn't around, you know, I was two different people. Three. I was the nurse, I was the mother, and I was his wife. And so I had these glimpses of hope, of normalcy with these other contexts, except with him. And I was trying to figure out the formula to fix him and minimizing how bad it was.
And I guess the question I have for you after hearing that is, when you are at work and you are with your children and they are not around, are you still thinking about them, about the time, okay, when I do get back home or I do have to deal with them, is it always sitting on the back burner?
Yes. It's always fear of what am I going to walk into? Because it was always there. Yes. But I had to hide it. I couldn't show that at work. I thought I couldn't. It didn't work very well. A lot of people already knew or suspected, but I was hiding it.
And are you at this point, because a lot you're doing here and a lot you're dealing with, what is your energy level at this point? And, you know, from the beginning to where we are now in your story, you know, how much is left in your tank at this point?
Yeah, no, there wasn't any, I couldn't fight. I just didn't have the, well, he had to win every fight, and his persistence, you could not beat that persistence because he had to win. And okay, so if he would start something, it'd be yelling and then it'd be shoving. And then he would have his hands around my neck. And if it got bad enough, it would be hitting. And I learned very quickly to back down before it escalated to the point of physical violence. You know, it was just easier. It was easier to back down because I would lose.
So you're in some ways, you're just conserving in some ways of like, how can I survive the day? How do I have enough energy to survive the day?
But my perspective was, how can I control his behavior? How can I fix him. Eventually, we did go into marriage counseling because I was holding our second child, who was less than 2 months old, and he was going to hit me with a chair. He had a wooden chair by the leg, and he had it over his head, and he was going to whack me with it, and I got just furious. So he called a counselor who was quite helpful. He tried a lot of different things, and he diagnosed my ex with an antisocial personality disorder. And I've been denying that for a long time, but I think it's true. That's too frightening for me to internalize. So I had to minimize that. But I do get it now, but at the time I was like, no, that can't be. So we had 3 boys, marriage is forever. Divorce is wrong. The kids are going to turn out terrible, terrible if you get divorced. That was my frame of reference. That was my thinking. And, you know, I still couldn't think more than 1 minute in front of 1 minute into the future. There was one night where we were, or one vacation, we went with my family, and he was so mean and so defensive that whole time. And finally on the last night, he was like so wound up. He's like, we're having this out right now. No. So we got in the car and we drove, and we're in an unfamiliar city. We drove and he stopped the car and he's just screaming at me. When I say jump, you jump. When I say get in the car, you get in the car. And every time he did that, he'd whack me on the head. And I'm sitting, and you know, it wasn't concussion worthy, but it was, he'd hit me on the head. And I'm sitting in the passenger seat, just kind of diminishing, just curling up into a ball. And finally, I wanted it to stop. And I said calmly, I'm leaving you. And he didn't hear me at first. Like, what? I'm leaving you. And then he changed his tune. Then he became Mr. Wonderful, Mr. Nice. And I didn't intend to leave him. That really was an empty threat. But it was just something to get him to stop. There was one night when I came home from work. I had worked an evening shift. And for some reason, he was home that night. And I had... you know, my shift ended. It was like 11:30, 11:45 before I got home. And I walk in the house, I walk in the back door, and he's got the music blaring. He's glaring at me and he's mad. He's furious that I got home late. And he screamed at me, shoved me all over the house, wanted me to apologize. And I knew I couldn't. I couldn't apologize because that would mean that every time I got off work, I would have to punch out one minute after the end of my shift. And I would have lost my nursing license because that would be patient abandonment. I mean, that's just not how it works. There was nothing I could do. There was a lull in the fight, and I stopped by the sink to get a drink of water. And I think he hit me with a closed fist. I don't know. I didn't see it coming. And he knocked me into the next room. There's water all over, and knocked the wind out of me. And the bugger tried to help me up because, you know, when you get the wind knocked out of you, you're like... And finally, when I could get enough air to even speak, all I could say was, get off me. And that was kind of a turning point. I knew that I had made a mistake by marrying him. It was still all on me. It was my fix and my mistake. It wasn't him. That was my turning point. And I knew that I had to leave. But I fully intended to wait until our youngest was out of high school, and he was 1. So my mantra, 17 years, 17 years, 17 years, I can make it 17 more years, because children should not be from broken homes. And, you know, the marriage counselor eventually had told me you wouldn't have survived. You wouldn't have lived. I would have either died by my hand or his, or I would have just lost myself completely. Final countdown, what happened in the end? I was getting ready for work one morning. And in those days, nurses didn't wear scrubs. They wore white. You'd get very creative with how many whites you wore and what you'd find that was white. And I was wearing a pair of jeans, white jeans that his sister had given me that I had to put a new zipper in, and they didn't fit. And anyway, so I'm getting ready at, you know, 6:30 in the morning, and I had the jeans on and I didn't have my shirt on yet. And he didn't want me to wear those jeans to work. And he tries to ripped them and he couldn't. And then he left the bathroom and he came back with a knife and he was going to cut those jeans off of me. And I got him off me and I went to work and I took care of a high risk labor patient the whole day. And then after work, I was like, wow, what just did happen to me? You know, I could separate it until after work. And I get home from work and he was gone. And every one of my uniforms was laying on the bed. And the message was pretty clear. You have other things to wear. You don't need to wear them. He was going to continue the fight. And he did. He continued the fight that night. He screamed at me some more. And in the meantime, I actually confided in a coworker. And that coworker saw the same counselor we did for a mental health issue. And she said to me, I have an appointment tomorrow. You take my appointment. I'm doing well. I don't need that appointment. You have to go see the counselor. So I did. Tuesday morning, I went to see the counselor. And he said to me, you're no longer safe in your own home. You have to leave. And my response, yeah, I have to work at 3. I'll do it tomorrow. And that's the state of mind I was in. You know, he's like, you have to go to the police. Okay, I'll do it tomorrow. So I went to work and I got home from work and he love bombed me. He love bombed me to death. And I there was nothing. I wasn't going to fall for it. He had the music playing and he had beer out and some cigarettes and he was going to have this romantic evening. And I shut the music off and turned the lights on and started screaming at him. And I it was one of those nights at work where I didn't really get anything to eat or drink. So started in on that beer and it went straight to my head and boy, did I let loose. And we didn't even have sex that night because I was just so mad at him. Like a knife, how dare you? How dare you pull a knife on me? Seriously, it wasn't the first time you had pulled a knife. But first I went to the domestic violence center and they showed me the power and control wheel. And I could look at that wheel and everything on that wheel he had done except bit me. He had never bit me. But everything else he had done to me. And so then I finally had to admit that I was an abused wife. That was the first time I actually admitted it. And so we went to the cops and they followed me home and they put him in handcuffs and took him away. So I wrote here, knife on Monday, counselor on Tuesday, jail on Wednesday, freedom on Thursday. That was the last time I ever lived with him. And he reacted by a smear campaign. And I knew that that was going to happen. And he was kind of love bombing me, but there was a restraining order. So he was very careful and he honored the restraining order. And then he eventually, there was no way I was going to file for divorce. Marriage is forever. I wasn't going to file. And so we started seeing each other in the counselor's office, which was the right thing to do. But eventually he wanted me to relocate to another state with him because he had a job offer in another state. And at first I didn't tell him anything. And I called him back the next day and said, I'm not going to relocate with you. And because you're taking me away from my support system and you're abusive. So I can't do that. And he was mad. And that was the end of the love bombing. That was the end of that. So, you know, I had the kids alone by myself. And I reset everything. We could have fun at mealtime and we could be happy and we could laugh. And, you know, the youngest two were age 1 and 2. They didn't know what was going on at all. The oldest was 7. And, you know, the counselor helped me explain things to him. And he says he doesn't remember anything. I don't know about that. He may have picked up on my denial. He may be in denial too, but he says he doesn't remember anything. And they didn't know any different growing up in a single parent household. They just didn't know what it was like to live with a mom and a dad. Anyway, I actually spent my life hiding behind my kids and just taking care of my kids and being as good of a mother as I could. Eventually, 6 months after we separated, the counselor told me it was time to file for divorce. So he left the state and I told him, I think that's a big mistake. You're going to lose your kids. You're going to lose your relationship with your kids. And he looked me in the eye and he said, fuck you. So I dropped it. And I believed I had my power back. I believed I did. And I believed it up until your podcast. He did not do the post-separation abuse. And I keep thinking, why? Why didn't he do that? His family moved every 5 years, and they left everything behind and relocated and started over. I think that's what he did. He left everything behind and moved on. There were a few things that he did afterwards about the kids, a few manipulations, but he knew he couldn't get anywhere with me. And we didn't have a dime to our names. We didn't have anything. So, you know, there wasn't a lot to fight over. He just walked away. He put his tail between his legs and left. So I have done my best to move on. I did not go into counseling. I should have. I didn't have the money or the time or the ability. Well, I had the ability. The counselor told me I had to go back to counseling, but that counselor had moved away. And I never did. And I should have. You know what my counseling was? I'd put the kids to bed and I would watch Forrest Gump. And there's a character in Forrest Gump called Jenny who was abused by her father. And anytime Jenny would be on the TV in the movie, I would cry and cry and cry. And I would cry over both me and Jenny. And that was my therapy. That did me a lot of good to just get it out and cry. 9 years of tears I got through with Forrest Gump.
So before we get to your words of wisdom, in this healing process that has been a very long time, and it sounds like you thought you were healed, or you thought maybe that you could have dealt with things, but then things came back up, and you listened to the show thinking that maybe this is like a true crime show of sorts, or like a show like, what's that one? Like Undercover Ex-Wives or something like that. I think that's something like that. And then you discovered that, oh, this isn't what I came for. So when you started listening to an episode, and do you remember what that episode was? I never asked you that.
It was the first time I heard the words Lundy Bancroft.
Okay.
So I was going in order, but I started at the most recent and went backwards. So I'm not sure which one it was.
So when that happened, there were flashbacks for you?
Yeah, there have been flashbacks all along.
So what got you, I guess, to be like, did you start binging? And were you just at that point like, oh boy, there's a lot of stuff here that I've never dealt with. And where do I begin? And, you know, how long until you eventually, I never asked you this, how long until you eventually contacted me when you started to listen?
Okay, so this was binging. It was binging. So every morning I'll get at least 1.5 episodes, and then all day Saturday. I'm just doing my laundry and doing my thing with my earbuds on. So a lot of binging. So it was a couple of weeks before I contacted you, but by that time I realized that I couldn't just listen to the stories. I needed to listen to the Q&As and the Lundy Bancroft, all those types of abusers. I mean, I could find evidence of every single one of them. And you know, that was the first time I realized how bad it was. Because I had minimized it all my life. And, you know, I didn't realize what was going on. And, you know, it was over 40 years ago, and I was like still in denial. My healing is really just listening to it and working through it and acknowledging it. I'm admitting that it happened and it was bad, and acknowledging that it was part of who I am. It's part of who I am. I don't have to like it. I don't have to appreciate it, but it is what it is. And that's only one part of who I am. That doesn't define me.
So before I said this before we get to the words of wisdom, I've done this twice. How are you different than the person at the end of the marriage? And how did you get there?
Oh, I reset. I totally reset things. And I knew what a normal home life was like. So, you know, I was divided into three, my professional relationship, my relationship as a mother, and my relationship with him. So I got rid of the relationship with him and I could move on professionally. I'd been back to school a million times and now I have a PhD. And I could move on with the children and be the mom I always wanted to be. So I was still kind of just minimizing that part of my life and pretending it didn't exist. However, I met a great guy and we're going to celebrate our 26th wedding anniversary in about a month. But I, you know, now I've grown up and I'm patient and I'm content. And so I can be what I always thought I wanted to be. My problem is I'm just kind of ignoring those 11 years. Those 11 years, I'm just ignoring those. And I haven't dealt with that yet. This is helping.
Okay. And now, for everyone listening, do you have any words of wisdom?
Yes, talk to people. Don't keep it in. Get some help. Get somebody to help you professionally would be best. But you know what? If something's going on that you don't like, find somebody to talk to. Listening to the answer is not an easy thing to do. But find people to talk to. And don't hide things. And I always say this, and it's kind of a cliche, listen to your gut. If your gut's telling you there's something wrong here, there's probably something wrong. And then, you know, don't let it define you. But don't deny that it happened. Make it part of your life, but don't make it be the hurt all that you are. You're so much more.
Well, Elsie, I really want to thank you for being here with me today and sharing your story. And, you know, what people don't realize, you know, you've described it is a horrific, you know, experience that you've gone through. And we've heard a lot of terrible things today. And you've been smiling and laughing on the other. Sometimes I think people might hear your laughter, but you've been smiling throughout this experience and this our conversation today. And I know for a lot of people it's like a nervous reaction, but at the same time, this person in this experience hasn't stolen this light that's inside you. And it's still there. And maybe it's a coping mechanism, but it's just the light of who you are. And
thank you.
It's for everyone who's listening, you know, it's a nice thing for people to hear. That you can find yourself in this way again and that you have this positive outlook about what has happened and how you're going to be moving forward and that there is a way. And I know for a lot of people, they don't think there is and that they'll never get there and it's going to be a lot of ups and downs. I mean, you're talking to me in 2024 and this happened
right
at the end of 1993 when it ended. So it's not going to be a short journey and it's not going to be a linear journey. And you being here and sharing everything, the little nuances of so many different tactics, it's going to help so many people, not just within the story and those nuances, just who you are and, you know, how you presented everything and just this light that is you. So I really can't thank you enough for being here today and sharing your story. And you're going to save somebody's life today So a big thank you from me and everyone for being here today.
Well, thank you for your podcast. I don't always appreciate it when it convicts me, but I do appreciate it.
Well, thank you for being here once again, Elsie. And if you want to be a guest on our show like Elsie was today, please do go to our website at narcissistapocalypse.com. Top of the page, there's a button that says guest form. When you click on that button, it takes you to our guest form page. And there you can read all of our instructions and either send us an email at narcissistapocalypse@gmail.com or fill out our guest form and press the submit button. And please do send it in the format that we ask for. And if you are someone that needs support, we have a support group at our website. So if you want to go to narcissistapocalypse.com, at top of the page, there's a button that says support group. When you click on that button, you can see that we have our very own safe social network. And inside, we have Zoom meetings every Wednesday night, Thursday afternoons, and Saturday nights. We have forum boards for you to post on to get the validation that you need from survivors just like you. It is a wonderful group of people on there. So if you need support, join our support group today. And if you need even more support, please do visit our friends at domesticshelters.org. At domesticshelters.org, they have articles and resources to help you make sense of what you're dealing with. They have every phone number, email address, web address for shelters and agencies, no matter how big or small the town you are in. Domesticshelters.org has it there. And another friend of our show is called Shelter Movers, and they can be found at sheltermovers.com. And Shelter Movers helps coercive control or domestic violence victims get out of their home, get all their stuff out of their home and into storage, including your pets and livestock too. It is only available in Canada right now, but they are a charitable organization and you can send donations to them to help survivors just like you. So if you want to donate to them or use their services, go to sheltermovers.com. And that is it for today's survivor story, for today's episode. So for myself and Elsie, we hope you have a good night.